I'm Andy Bienstock, host for Jazz and Big Band Music here on WYPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make live streams like this one difficult to keep going. Stand up for public media and help fortify WYPR's future. Tell your member of Congress you support WYPR by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org. Thanks.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. My guest today is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Richard Worley. He stepped into that role a little under 2 years ago, capping a long career with the BPD. Violent crime is way down in our city, and April homicides reached an unprecedented low, not seen since the early 1970s. It's a welcome and dramatic change from only a few years ago when Baltimore was among the many places across the nation to see a spike in violence. Last week, Maryland Attorney General Anthony Brown released a shocking report that revealed that over the past two decades, a dozen deaths, which occurred while suspects were in BPD custody, should have been classified as homicides. Those cases include Tyrone West, whose sister has been calling attention to his death in North Baltimore since 2013. Commissioner Worley is with us for the hour today. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, and the commissioner joins me in Studio B. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let me ask you about a couple of recent cases. There was a police-involved shooting about a week and a half ago up on York Road. What can you tell us about the status of that investigation?
It's still an open investigation, but basically what happened is our officers tried to stop a gentleman. He took off running. One of our sergeants who was in a vehicle tried to cut him off, and as he tried to cut him off, the suspect shot through the car at the sergeant. Other officers returned fire and striking and killing the suspect. It's still an active investigation, but the officers did a phenomenal job. And we, quite honestly, we got lucky. He wasn't able to shoot the sergeant in the vehicle. And we should be releasing our body-worn camera and everything maybe this week, but if not, early next week.
It seems to be taking a long time for the body-worn camera footage to come out, or is that just me?
No, it just we usually have it out within about 10 days. So all we do is, the reason we review it all is we have four or five different officers at this time that were involved in the incident. So we review it all and then we put it in, and we also show it to the family of the gentleman who was killed. We show it to the NAACP and we show it to our elected officials. And then we put it out for public view because we want the family to see it. We don't want the family to see it first on the news. So we make sure we take care of those. That takes a little coordination, and then we release it to the public. But we make sure that it's set up so that everything is seen, because in real time, it's really tough. So we slow everything down and make it so that everything is shown exactly what our officer saw.
But it doesn't sound like we're going to see anything particularly shocking or that would indicate any contrary interpretation to what happened.
No, not at all.
This suspect fired at police.
Not at all. He hit the police car at least twice on the side and once right through the windshield above the sergeant's head.
What about the Brooklyn Day investigation? I mean, this has been going on now for 2 years. The prosecutions seem to be over. They just sentenced one of the last defendants in that case. But that investigation is still open. Why is that taking so long?
Well, it's still going to be open until we're able to charge a suspect for the murders, and mainly because there were so many casings there, and we still don't have a witness who can put the gun in the hands of the suspect who shot the young lady, and killed the young lady and young gentleman. So we have to continue. The case will stay open. At some point, maybe we arrest somebody that has information. Maybe somebody decides to come forward. We've scoured everything with video, ballistics. The part of the problem was we had several different people shooting in a couple of different areas. So it takes a while, and then sometimes we're never able to charge someone with the homicide simply because the evidence isn't there. So we have to wait. We haven't closed the investigation. We'll continue to investigate. And if we get any new leads, we will follow up on those like we do with every case. We have a cold case squad in their homicide unit that has multiple cases that we'll have them look into if something new develops.
And in a case like this, I mean, in any case, one of the things you look for is motive. Do you have any sense, are we any closer to understanding what started it? I mean, all of a sudden, all these people started shooting. Do we have any notion of why?
I think what we come down to is the fact that one group started shooting, and we don't know who they were shooting at, and then everyone assumed they were being shot at, and so many weapons were on the scene with individuals that multiple people started firing, and we end up with over 100 casings on the scene.
So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the murder rate and the non-fatal shooting rate here in Baltimore has gone way down. This the month of April, the lowest number of homicides recorded since the 1970s. But that number has inched up. By May 1st, we had 39 homicides here in the city of Baltimore. By today, which is, what, the 20th of May, not quite finished with the month, where we have 10 homicides that have happened. We're at 49. Any sense of why that is? Sometimes people point to, you know, warmer weather leads to more incidents, but are you concerned?
No, I'm not. We've had several cases this month that are just strange cases. We had two co-workers get into a fight and one stab another. So some of those things that are men and women, the best deployment you could put out there aren't going to prevent them. And if most people, if you say Baltimore has 10 homicides in 20 days, that's actually good, but 10 is still 10 too many. So the month of May, we average around, I think we had 14 or 15 last year. April was just so tremendous.
Yeah, it's still down year to year.
Yes, yeah. April was just such a tremendous month. We hadn't had that. We started keeping records in 1970. And the lowest month from 1970 on was a couple with seven. Five was unprecedented. And I was watching it. Believe me, I was watching as it was going along because it's even with us, it's unusual that you see where you don't have a shooting or a homicide in a day. But we've had a spike over this last couple days, the last weekend, and it's all too often a story we've been talking about is our young people. Had a case last night where a 15-year-old shot a 14-year-old, and we just these young people just have weapons, and we just have to do better with our young people.
Yeah, it's access to guns. That's certainly part of it, but there's, you know, it's a very multifaceted set of reasons. Juvenile crime is something I know that's, you know, very top of mind for you and your department. There was a incident. Towards the end of last month, the 25th of April, there were 16 juveniles arrested for various crimes, robberies, stolen vehicles, burglary and stuff, and 11 of them had prior arrest records. So obviously you've all always been right at the center of this argument about what to do when juveniles commit adult-level crimes. Where do you see that argument going? Where do you see that conversation headed? We've got Vincent Schiraldi, the head of the Department of Juvenile Services, continue to be criticized for what his critics would say is being too gentle with these kids who are committing crimes over and over again.
Yeah, I think in that particular weekend, we had two of them, I believe, two or three of them were charged as adults because they were crimes that would have been basically would have been felonies had they been committed as adults. So they were charged as adults. And we had the toughest part was we had two of the young people had over 9 arrests. So clearly something's not working with those young men because they continue to reoffend. And as young people, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to make two mistakes. But once they start continually being part of the system, we've got to correct it. And I say we as a system, the whole criminal justice system. And I think part of the problem with DJS is that they've the space. I've been told that the bed space is just we just don't have enough room for the young people. And after COVID,
and so a lot of kids are being released to the custody of their guardian.
Yeah, I would defer to Secretary Girardi on that, but I believe that is one of the issues. But we've got to come up with a better system because these young people are our future. Now, I bring this up on every time we talk about young people is that between the ages of 10 and 19, there's about 60,000 young men and women in Baltimore. We're probably talking about 200 of that 60,000. So the majority of our young men and women
are out there doing fabulous things,
doing great things in school and sports and the arts. We just have to get a better grip on these ones that are out there causing chaos so that they can go head in the right direction. Because if not, they're just going to become adults and part of the system, and then their lives are ruined.
Now, virtually every category of crime, with the exception of shoplifting, as I understand it, is down in terms, you know, statistically. Shoplifting is a whole other universe.
Yes.
You walk into any CVS and, you know, the deodorant is under lock and key, for gosh sakes. So that's a whole other notion. But that trend is a national trend, and that trend continues to happen here in Baltimore. When it comes to the summer, you know, which we're on the cusp of here, it's often the case that you deploy things differently. You change some things around. What's up for this summer? The mayor has ordered curfews for kids in the past couple of summers. Is that going to happen again? What is the approach this summer, and is it any different than it's been the last couple summers?
Yeah, I think we've been pretty successful the last couple summers. The one thing with curfews, that is something that the mayor does with his office. We aren't involved in that at all, and it's something that they've done a really good job with. And another thing that the city has done a good job with is a couple years ago, if you remember, at the beginning of the year, we had a lot of young people who were being shot, were victims of homicides and shootings. So everyone came together in a room, and what do we do for these young people? So what the solution was, let's start giving them events. And we have events every weekend just about for our young people to keep them occupied, get them out, let them enjoy, because they're going to go out and do things. They're kids. So they're going to go out and enjoy things. Some of them are going to get into things they shouldn't, and that's when we step in. But there, this weekend, for example, there's a huge weekend. It's Memorial Day weekend. The city's going to celebrate Artscape. There's an event for young people in Druid Hill Park. So all these things are out there. We just finished Preakness, and Preakness had multiple other events. So our officers are constantly deployed downtown. We have a downtown deployment. That no longer just is downtown and when the Inner Harbor. We go to Fells Point. We go to Federal Hill. But we can't do it alone. We have all of our other partners. We have the sheriff's office. We have the school police. We have our federal partners who all assist us in this because it's everyone. We've all got to work together to make summer successful, and we will. We'll get through the summer. In policing, you used to always wish the summers away, but I started thinking a couple months ago, it's like, this is the great time of year. It was a couple years ago. We're not going to wish it away. We're going to do better, and we're going to make people feel safe. And one thing that I have seen from being around the city and being downtown, a lot more people are coming to the harbor and the downtown area than I've seen in many years. And some of them have said they've done
even it. Though there's not all that much going on at the harbor.
Correct. It's still a beautiful place, even if you just want to come down and
walk around.
But there's still stores there, and you still have great restaurants and a great scenery. You got a historical Federal Hill. You have tons of things to do downtown. My wife looks for stuff for us to do every weekend. And she finds things in Baltimore. I don't know what app she has, but she's got restaurants and locations and things that you have to see in Baltimore. And she's got them lined up for us to do. So there are things to do, and the city does a great job. It's a beautiful city. Come down and take a look at it. Even though the Orioles are struggling, you have the Orioles here, but hopefully they can turn it around. You're only 50 games into the season. You got 112 whatever games left. So always optimistic.
Spoken like a former minor league baseball player.
Always optimistic. It's still a long season.
It is indeed. And boy, these last few games have really been long. Richard Worley is Baltimore's police commissioner. We'll have more with the commissioner on the other side of a quick break. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Is food addictive? Does the food industry in America create ultra-processed foods that are formulated to make them addictive, and should food be regulated like tobacco or alcohol? We'll talk about it tomorrow with Monica Reinagle and food policy advocate Ted Kyle. And as well, I'll speak with the Reverend Derek Weston. He's the host of the Food and Faith podcast. So that's coming up tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore Police Commissioner Richard Worley. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So, Commissioner, the group violence reduction strategy, in many quarters credited with the big gains that we've made in public safety and reduction of violence. The plan was to have a group violence reduction strategy in place in all districts in the city by the end of this year. So we're almost halfway through the year. How's progress on that going? I guess the Southern District is the one that's targeted for the next implementation.
Yeah, right? The Southern District should be online pretty soon. That will be the fifth of our nine districts. And then we should move pretty quickly around the rest of the city. And it's going really well. We fell a little behind schedule because we wanted to make sure we did it right. Because if the one thing that does basically a success for failure is to do things too quickly. So we had the success in the Western, we moved to the Southwest, and then we suffered a little bit of a setback in the Western. It reverted back to some of the things. So we had to fix that, and now we moved from the Southwest to the Central to the Eastern, and then we're going to go to the Southern. And it's going really well. It's a partnership, and it's a focused deterrence model where you have the state's attorney, the mayor's office, and the police commissioner, the three leaders of the city agencies, and then you have Monsey under the mayor's office, where we all work together.
Monsey is the mayor's office of neighborhood safety and engagement.
Yes, mm-hmm. They all work together, and basically it's a three-pronged approach where we give you an option to get out of the violence and put down the guns. If you don't, Monsey gives you all those opportunities to, with ROCA and all these other agencies to help you get a job, get better education, move if you have to. All these things we offer you for you to take. If you don't take them, you don't have to take them, but you have to put the guns down. If not, we come in, we'll do the investigation. We will indict individuals that are causing the violence. We then turn it over to the state's attorney's office. They prosecute, and the drug trafficking organization is taken out. Then Monsey and all the other wraparound services come in to stabilize the neighborhood. So it's all three, and it's not just us three, because we've used the attorney general's office. We've used the U.S. attorney. In our investigations, we've all used all of our federal partners, all of our state partners. The governor's office has given us resources and funding to do things we would not have been able to do without his support. So it's everybody working together to make Baltimore a success.
So what does it take? What kind of work in advance do you need to do before you set it up and, you know, announce, okay, now we've got it? An implementation in the Southern District. I mean, when you take a look at the setbacks that did occur in the Western District, what did you learn? Why were there setbacks there? And then how does that inform your decision? But in terms of the work before the fact, what's involved in that?
It's a lot of the work done. I would almost say it's almost as much done before as after, because what happens is you get a group through the University of Penn, through department, the state's attorney, all of us work together, and we look at the violence, the shootings that have occurred in the Southern, for example, where we're getting ready to, for over the last, I think it's the last 2 years. And then we look to see, okay, what names continually come up? What groups are driving this violence? And then there's a scorecard where you classify them. And then we pick the top groups. Okay, these are the ones that are driving the violence in this area. And it's a people-based strategy. So we're going to try to get the people to put down the guns. It's not a geographically based strategy. So the first thing is identify who we know is driving the violence. Then we tell them, listen, we know you're driving this violence. If you don't put down the guns, we're going to do an investigation, and we're not only going to put you away, we're going to indict you and everyone that's in your drug trafficking organization. But here are your options. You have ROCA. You can go into ROCA, 18 to 25 years old, I believe it is.
16 to 24.
16 to 24. Yep. I was close. 16 to 24. And they give you so many options, and they are relentless with their follow-through. And staying on the individual. And then you have Monsi, who has all of their wraparound services with YAP and all these other individuals who, okay, you don't have to put the guns down. I mean, you don't have to take the services, but you definitely have to stop the violence. But give them the opportunities to do all these things. And then if you decide no, and you continue to do the violence in the areas, then we open the investigation. We start looking into it. We have meetings every week where we discuss shootings. As a group member involved, we will indict you with our federal partners. Then we turn over to a prosecutor, the state's attorney, U.S. attorney, attorney general, to prosecute the cases and put you away for a long time. And then even more services come in to stabilize that neighborhood so nobody else takes it over. And that's when you have success, when you can give a neighborhood back to a community that has been victimized for a long period of time by these drug dealers and violence.
So again, when you take a look at what happened in the Western District, where there was a little bit of a backslide, what did you learn as to the reasons that happened? Because there are some people, you mentioned it's person-based rather than geographic-based, but there are some people who say, well, okay, if you crack down on the Western, we'll just move it to someplace else.
Well, the first thing we had to do is we reorganized the group violence unit within the department a little bit. We gave them some extra resources. They didn't have enough resources. And then I think what happened is we moved a little too quickly into the Southwest, and we didn't keep our thumb on the or a foot on the gas pedal in the Western. And then you throw in that we redistrict in there as well.
Yeah, they changed.
So it changed some things. Yeah. That happened a little bit after that. But once we realized, okay, these are the mistakes we did in the Western, we went back, we stabilized the Western, and then we just, that caused us to slow, let's slow down, make sure we have everything in place before we move anywhere else. That's why it's taken us a little more time to get across the city, because we want to do it right. We don't want to have to go back and do it again. So if it takes a little longer and it's successful, I'm all for it, instead of rushing it and being unsuccessful.
You mentioned, when you identify some of these folks who are involved in violence, it's often drug-related. But I hear from the folks at ROCA, because I've had them on, I've had the folks from Safe Streets on, that a lot of this violence now for some time is animated by individual beefs. One guy just ticks off another guy, and things escalate too quickly. And sometimes some of the work with these folks involves, conflict resolution, how to react, how to analyze what you're thinking, how to think it through so it doesn't have a violent end. But you seem to be indicating that the drug, the gangs are still a big issue. How would you, what's the proportion of these cases, gang versus individuals?
Well, the drug trafficking organizations are still there, but it may not be them that's involved in it. It may be just a beef, and sometimes it's a beef within the own organization. I think what's happened, and I don't think we really know the full impact of what COVID has done to our young people, and the fact that they don't know how to communicate with each other, and a lot of them, and they don't know how to resolve conflicts. They automatically go to gun violence, and because they didn't have those interactions in school, or even for 2 years, we were kind of shut down. And I think they need conflict resolution. That's what Rocha does greatly. But some of it is
They are amazing at that.
It's just the fact that the people hang together. It may not be a drug trafficker. It's just kind of a group, a neighborhood group. So you just have to get them to resolve their conflicts without weapons, and give them opportunities to do things other than resort to violence or deal drugs. Go and get a job, get an education. And do things that make you a productive citizen, because that's what we want. We don't want we can't arrest our way out of it. We're never going to do that. We've proven that that's not going to happen. So we want our young people who are involved in these violence to put the guns down and find something else to do, and become a successful contributor to society.
What's the clearance rate these days for homicide? As I mentioned, we're at 49 homicides for the year for 2025. We heretofore have been solving more of them than we used to. But where are we at this point?
65% in homicides and 46% in our shootings. Both of those are up significantly. And our homicides dropped a little bit recently because we got hit with several cases. I'd put our homicide and our shooting detectives up against anybody in the country. And I'm extremely proud of the work all of our men
and
women.
Is it possible that we could ever get to 85 or 90% that we solved virtually most of them, all of them?
I think anything.
Or is that a pipe dream?
No, I think anything's possible. And the one thing that I think is helping us a great deal is the community. I think a lot of us in criminal justice leave out the community, how important and vital a part they are to the success of all of us. Because if they're not cooperating, they're not giving us tips, we're not going to solve cases. Our detectives are great, but they're not magicians. They can't solve everything. We can use cameras and technology, but you still need that person that says, hey, this person did that, and I don't think it's right, and so go out and get them. And we were getting – the one thing I've noticed, I read our Evertel stuff, which is what we put all of our shootings and our homicides and canned guns. A lot of calls are coming in about people being armed with guns, and we're able to pick them off and take them into custody. I've never seen that.
So the community is saying, hey, yes, this guy has a weapon.
Yes. I've never seen so many of those calls in the past where we're doing a better job as well. Our officers are better trained to deal with those things. And I can't talk enough about the quality of the training and how our officers are doing with de-escalation and reform of our police department while lowering crime at the same time.
And, of course, a lot of this is directly related to the consent decree, which ordered, an overhaul of the relationship between the police department and members, particularly of the African-American community. Two of the sections of the consent decree have been cleared. You know, you're no longer bound by that agreement. But this is now we're in our eighth year, so this is not happening overnight. I asked Evan Shea this. He's a member of the monitoring team of the consent decree, and he seemed to think that the answer to this question was no. When I asked if the Trump administration, the fact that there's a very new, different Justice Department now than there was during the Biden administration, was that going to affect the consent decree, the enforcement of the consent decree, and the progress? Because the president has made no secret of the fact that he doesn't think consent decrees are a good idea.
I don't think it will either. The consent decree gave us the blueprint for how to reform our police department. We're 8 years into it now. We never really bought into it probably the first 2 or 3 years. So now the officers have bought in. We've got the training that we need, better training than we've ever had. Better resources. The mayor had a good contract last year to help keep some of our people here. But the Judge Bedard, is tough, but he's fair. And I think we're going to see this thing through until we satisfy all the paragraphs of the consent decree. But even when the consent decree is gone, Department of Justice isn't overlooking us. We're not going to revert back to the police department where we did things that were unconstitutional. We are where we are now, and the men and women have changed, and we're a different police department, more of a guardian than a warrior. And I think it's the city and the citizens are noticing it, and I'm extremely proud of everything that we're doing.
Yeah, and given that progress, which I think everybody would acknowledge is significant, there still are instances where individual members of the department are, you know, identified as being problematic. There's a detective named Calvin Moss. He was written about by our colleagues at the Baltimore Banner. He's been added to a list that prosecutors have of don't call this person to testify because he's not a credible witness because of some behavior. When that sort of thing happens, how is that being dealt with differently than, you know, prior to the consent decree and prior to, you know, this current climate in the department?
Yeah, all the cases, when we get a case, the case is thoroughly investigated by our Public Integrity Bureau. And in Detective Moss's cases, he's been thoroughly investigated. If discipline was warranted, discipline was given, he served it. And the most recent thing that came up that put him on the do not call list is being investigated. And it's an open investigation, but I can't discuss it a whole lot. But the do not call list is the state's attorney's list of officers he doesn't think are credible witnesses, so we can't call. He won't call them.
Yeah,
as witnesses.
He just doesn't think they're going to do him any good when they go to prosecute a case.
So, but in all of Detective Moss's cases, they've been investigated thoroughly. If discipline was warranted, which it was in some and wasn't in others. It was given. He's accepted everything, and he's done what we've asked him to do as far as to serve any penalties. This investigation is ongoing, and I'm sure it'll turn out to whatever the results are. Everybody will move forward, and hopefully he can finish out his career with BPD and be productive.
Baltimore Police Commissioner Richard Worley. We'll have more with the commissioner after a quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wipr.org. And Commissioner, let me ask your indulgence as you sit with us and remind listeners that before we go to this break, each week here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do this to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. As we've discussed today, 49 people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city so far this year. Police have identified 3 people who were killed last week. They are Julio Delgado, age 36, Albert Manning, age 37, and Tanya Gray. She was 23 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Baltimore City Police Commissioner Richard Worley joins me in Studio B. Worley is a veteran of nearly 30 years with the department. He began his career as a beat cop with the BPD in 1998, patrolling in the city's Western District. He's been Baltimore's top cop since the summer of 2023. To join us, we're at 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wipr.org. So, Commissioner, I want to ask you about a report that was released last week by the Attorney General of the state of Maryland, Anthony Brown. The governor was part of that press conference to release this report. They found that they looked into cases that had been determined by David Fowler, who's a former medical examiner. He held that position for about 17 years. He retired 6 years ago, in which 36 cases across the state were incorrectly classified. They should have been homicides. They were not classified as such. 12 of those cases, the majority, or in other words, more in our jurisdiction in Baltimore City than in any other jurisdiction. This is what Attorney General Brown had to say when he released this report last week.
The audit report's findings reveal significant discrepancies that demand our attention and response. They suggest medical examiners persistently misclassified restraint-related homicides that occurred in police custody. In 36 of the 87 cases, our expert panel unanimously determined that deaths were homicides where the OCME had previously concluded they were either undetermined, accidental, or natural. In another 5 cases, 2 of 3 independent reviewers determined that the death should have been classified as a homicide. These 41 combined cases show a failure to apply the standard practices of certifying homicides and reveal patterns that are consistent with the possibility of both racial bias and pro-police bias.
Racial bias and pro-police bias is really the reason the consent decree was put in place, you know, 8 years ago. This can be a big step back for the consent decree and for the progress that the department has made in improving the relationship with the community. One of these cases that they identified was a gentleman named Tyrone West. His sister has been out for more than 10 years, basically accusing the police of what the attorney general found the police may have done. Now, none of these cases, they've been reclassified as homicides, not guilt in the homicide hasn't been assigned in every case. But what's your perspective? How do you think of this? What does this mean for the department moving forward?
Well, it's alarming that this happened with the state's attorney. I mean, not the state's attorney. I'm sorry, with the medical examiner. But it is something that we investigated some of the cases. But in the Tyrone West case, I believe it was already classified as a homicide, and they wanted it to look at it again. And we haven't been told to open or look at investigations yet. That's another step in the process. But I think the fact that it was something that came out of the office of the medical examiner that doesn't show that we did anything wrong. It just shows that he classified things wrong. So if we have to reinvestigate or we have to open up another investigation or open a investigation that hasn't been investigated yet, we can do that. And we're willing to do the transparency. We'll be transparent along the way. I think the most recent case for us was 2014. So it's been 10 plus years for any of those cases. So most of the people that are in these positions now were not in the positions that they were in 10 years ago. They're in like our homicide major. I believe he was probably an officer or sergeant 10 years ago. So we have people in place now, and whatever we have to do, we'll do. We'll work along with the attorney general, the state's attorney, the Maryland State Police, because they're going to be involved as well. And I still think we have the best homicide detectives. If they have to look at it, we'll open the cases. So we're willing to help in any way we can to make sure that these cases get classified and properly or fully investigated. And if there are anything that was wrong with the medical examiner rule, then we'll look at it.
Are you concerned that it you know, represents to the community a step back, that this is a reminder of how things used to be, that there was, you know, police misconduct that was covered up in this case or potentially covered up by the medical examiner? This is the same guy who testified in the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis, saying that George Floyd did not die of by homicide, but rather of a heart condition, for which he was roundly criticized by a number of other medical examiners, as well as other people. But in terms of this relationship, this ever tender relationship between the community and the department, do you think this is going to be a big setback?
I don't think so. I think what's happened is you're talking about 10 years ago. Our department is totally different than it was 10 years ago. We're different than we were 5 years ago. Most of them, probably a majority of the men and women on the department, or a good portion, weren't even police officers 10 years ago. So we've trained differently. We've done things so much better, and we're so much of a different police department. And this isn't something that anyone did wrong that has been ruled as anyone did wrong, other than him classifying the cases wrong. The investigations, if they're going to prove that something did wrong, those will be done. But this all lies in the medical examiner's office. It doesn't fall on, like, doesn't say the police department did anything wrong. And again, it's 10 years ago, and latest case is 2014, and we're so much better, and we've made so much progress now that I don't think that this is going to affect with the community.
Let's go to the phones. We have a caller, Mike, on the line from Baltimore. Caller, welcome. Mike, welcome to the program with Richard Worley, our commissioner of police.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you for having me on. We have an entitled male, a white male fentanyl enthusiast problem here in Hamden. It's extremely significant to the point we're probably going to turn into Kensington Avenue in Philadelphia, if you're familiar with that. We don't want that. I spoke with one of your beat officers off the record, and I said, why are we letting armed fentanyl enthusiasts live in Roosevelt Park? And his response that there was no political or community will to solve the problem. And I don't necessarily disagree with him. As a matter of fact, I 100% completely agree with him. But I want to give a thank you to Sergeant Olivo for coming to the community meetings. He's an awesome officer, and I appreciate everything he does for our safety. But if the politicians and the community aren't going to stand up to stop the entitled white male fentanyl enthusiasts in Hamden, what can we do?
The first thing I would tell you is if that officer is telling you that, he's a police officer, right? He can go out and make arrests. It doesn't matter. The politicians don't have to tell us to make arrests. This is part of the problem with some of the, and I talk about a very few number of our officers who still have not bought into this culture change that you are the change agent. If you see problems in Hamden, work with the community, make the arrests, and eradicate the person from the community that's causing the issues. It can start at the officer level. So his excuse to you that people above him doesn't want that, regardless of where it falls, politicians, police department, wherever, he is a change agent that can make arrests, that can have an impact. If he's too lazy to do that, then that's on him, and we can work on that. But if that officer is basically just giving you an excuse that isn't a valid excuse, just so you won't ask him a question. So the fact that if he doesn't want to do his job, then maybe he should find another profession. But he can go out and make an arrest and help that community as easily as every other officer. And 99% of them would rather go out and solve the problem than blame it on something else. Because I don't care what anybody else thinks. We are police officers. We can make the change. Our job is to make arrests. Our job isn't to worry about what happens when the prosecution goes or when it gets above us. We make the arrest. We take the individual out of the neighborhood, and then we let Mr. Bates put him away, and then we eradicate the issue. But offering excuses doesn't fly with me, and I don't think that was a very good response by the officer. And that's not quite the way that we want to look at anything.
All right. Thanks for that call, Mike. And Commissioner, the larger issue of fentanyl and opioids, our partners at the Baltimore Banner won a Pulitzer Prize for the terrific reporting they did about the scope of the crisis here in Baltimore. He mentions entitled white fentanyl users. There's also a number of older African-American men who are addicted to opioids. When it comes to, you know, those situations when an officer encounters somebody who's clearly has a drug problem and is using drugs and is under the influence of opioids, but give us an example of what that training now entails. What do you do? Do you arrest that person automatically? What is the beat cop told to do these days? What is he or she trained to do to confront the opioid crisis, which in is one of the categories that's going down as well. We've got fewer deaths from opioid overdoses even, but still a long way to go.
Yeah, well, first get into the mayor's office did a fabulous job with the opioid manufacturers.
They've been suing the heck out of them.
I gave an 8-hour deposition. One of my lieutenant colonels gave three different depositions. So, and they're getting the money into the city to help, because arresting their way out of that is not going to work either. We've proven that. You've got to get them treatment, and you've got to get them just like the focus deterrence on the violence. You got to do something like that with the drug dealers. Get them off the drugs, first of all. But a way to do that is to if there is an arrestable offense, you can make the arrest. That gets them into the court system where the court can require that they get treatment. Just saying, oh, it's somebody else's fault. Make an arrest, do a referral. You don't even have to make an arrest. You can refer them to these drug rehabilitation centers so the person can get help. But if you do make an arrest, that puts them in front of the judge, and that makes the judge, gives the judge the authority to say, if you don't get this treatment or you don't go to this program, we're going to continue, and you may get your case steaded until you complete the program. And that way it gets them off the drugs, because that could be the first step. There's so many different avenues out there to get people off drugs, because it hasn't been a problem. Overdoses are a huge problem. They've been going down. The city has done a good job. It's a health crisis that we've dealt with as a health crisis. And of course, if someone is unconscious or something like that, the Narcan is literally a lifesaver.
Sure. In our last couple of minutes, I want to ask you about recruitment. That's long been an issue that you and I have talked about, for a couple of years now. How's that going? I understand the latest recruiting class has been a bit larger than in years past, but is that enough to make up for the number of people retiring?
Yes. It is going really well. It started off last year. The very first step to keeping some of our people here was through the FOP and the city coming to a really good contract for our officers who have more than 20 years that are eligible to retire. That's keeping a lot of our older officers, more experienced officers here. Now we're in another contract that where we kind of try to balance out everything to keep our younger officers here. But we changed companies to a new recruitment company, a new advertising company. Been phenomenal. We've got a class of 50 in the academy. We're getting ready to start a class of over 60. And I think it is going really, really well. We've got 117, I believe, in classes now, and another class of 60 that's getting ready to start. So it's going really well. And hopefully with this kind of recruitment and the attrition slows down, we might be up to where we need to be, 2,600 cops in 4 or 5 years, hopefully.
Where do we stand, given the fact that the mayor has told the police department, the fire department, and other agencies that some of their funds have to be frozen for this fiscal year because of budget concerns? How does that affect overtime that you need because you still are, shorthanded when we have events, et cetera, just in our last few seconds here?
Yeah, it affects it a little bit, but there's some things that we can cut corners on with some different units that we can change around. But it's all there was an audit that we didn't do well with the overtime in the past, so we've put in some really good restrictions. We have a dashboard where our members can look at, and they're doing a much better job with the overtime, and I think we can manage it. One thing I give my cops, when we give our members, not just the police, the professional members, give them a function, give them a challenge, and tell them why they're doing it, they'll go out and do just about anything. And I think we've proven that with the violence. They've done a tremendous job with less people. Now we've got to do some with the overtime to cut that, and I think we'll be fine. I'm not so much worried about the cuts. I think we'll continue to move on and grow and make the city safer.
All right, and we are approaching overtime right here on Midday. So that's all the time we have. Richard Worley, the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. Thank you, sir, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. We'll talk about whether or not food is addictive. Ted Kyle of Conscient Health and Derek Weston of Creation Justice Ministries will join us as well with Monica Reinagle. Fresh Air is up next. Jake Tapper of CNN talks about his very much talked about book, Original Sin. That's the book about President Joe Biden. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. I am grateful. Have a great day.
You're tuned to 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.